Okay, understanding one-dimensional wave functions is really important. That's why you do this stuff with Ervin meets Goldilocks. And the way it works is this. This, remember, is the Schrödinger function, H psi equals E psi. Divide both sides by psi, and then you get the kinetic energy plus the potential energy equals the total energy. Okay. But you can rearrange this so that the only thing on the left is the curvature of psi. And then you have a recipe for the curvature of psi, the wave function you're looking for, which is a solution then of the Schrödinger equation. So you have a recipe for its curvature in terms of a bunch of other things. But fortunately, most of those other things are known. Remember that it's going to be such that it curves away from zero when the potential energy is greater than the total. That's negative kinetic energy. And it curves towards zero when the kinetic energy is positive. But its actual value is given. You need to know these other things. Fortunately, they're given to you. The mass, the constant, and the potential energy as a function of position are given to you. That's the problem. You want to find psi. So then this curvature recipe allows you to trace out psi. If you know where it starts, and we'll assume that it starts on the left with a value of 1. Now, how can we know that it starts with a value of 1? Maybe it's pi or 3/16 or something like that. Okay, how can we start with 1? Notice what would happen if we... Remember, the only thing that psi has to do is satisfy the wave equation, give the kinetic energy the curvature that's proper, right? And not go to infinity. That's all it has to do. Okay. And if we use this formula to trace it out, then it's bound to work that way, right? But how do we know that it starts at 1? Okay? Notice what would happen if we, say, doubled psi, made it twice as big. So the denominator gets twice as big. What would happen to the curvature? So we drew psi on a piece of rubber, and then we stretched it to be twice as high. Okay? So the number gets twice as high. What happens to the curvature when we stretch the thing out? Debbie? Pardon me? Well, I thought you were holding your hand up. Well, guess. So you have the function written here, and it has a certain height at any given time. Here's zero. We stretch it up and down, okay, and make it twice as big. So every point gets twice as big. And the curvature will change, too, right, when we stretch it out. By how much, do you guess? Do you know how to do derivatives? The derivative, suppose you multiply by 2, multiply a function by 2, and then take the derivative. You know what you do if you do have a constant in there? You just take the constant out, right? So the curvature, the first derivative gets twice, the slope gets twice as big, and the curvature gets twice as big. So the curvature, so if you change the scale, if you make psi twice as big, what happens to the curvature? Gets twice as big. And what happens to the kinetic energy? Nothing. Right? So you can multiply it by any number you want to. And if it was good to begin with, if it has the right kinetic energy to begin with, it's still got the right kinetic energy. Okay? So we can scale it by any factor we want. And what we'll do is scale it by such a factor that the very first number we're interested in is 1. Okay, so I can arbitrarily do that, no problem. Okay, so we can assume it starts with initial value of 1 in our computer program we're writing. Okay, and with an initial slope of 0. That's not so obvious that the initial slope could be taken to be 0, but I'll show you that real shortly that that's okay too. So we start with an initial slope of 0 over on the left, And then what we do, so we know M, we know C, we know V, we know psi. We take it to be 1 at the very first point. Okay? So all we need on the right is E. So we're just going to guess what E is. Okay? And then what we know is the curvature of psi. So the curvature of psi tells us if we know what the slope was at the beginning, if we know how curved it is, we know what the next slope is going to be. Right? So we can get the next point along there. And then we can just go to that point. We now have a new value of psi, right? But we have the same E. The potential energy will have changed as we move across because the potential energy was some shape, right? But we just recalculate and get the next slope, the next slope, the next slope, and just trace the line out. See how we do it? Because we have this formula for the curvature, if we guess the right E. Okay? Now, so that's what this little program, Goldilocks, does, right? You guess an E, and it traces out what psi would look like, which satisfies Schrödinger's equation. It must, because that's what you're using to generate the curve. Unless it's curving so fast that it's not a good approximation to take little tiny steps, right? Straight steps. Right? If it's curving really, really fast, you have to take really, really tiny steps. And that's something you can adjust in the program to make it smaller and smaller if indeed it's curving rapidly. But of course, it takes longer to calculate. Okay, so this looks great. If we're using this, it's bound to work. Right? If we're using Schrödinger's equation to calculate this curvature and take small enough steps, then we're bound to satisfy Schrödinger's equation, but the wave function still might not be right. What could make it wrong? It could go to infinity. And it's not allowed to do that. Okay, so let's look. Let's suppose this is the potential energy, this line here. Okay? So it's Hooke's law. Looks pretty much like Hooke's law. Although the bottom of a Morse potential looks very much like Hooke's law. Okay, so we're going to make a guess and see how we do. So we guess 21 kilocalories per mole. We start off at the left. This is zero of the wave function plot. We're going to start at a value of 1, which is going to be really tiny on here. And we're going to take a step to the right and then recalculate and take another step and trace this out. Okay? So, notice that there's going to be a problem in some regions. Within this region, where this is the total energy that we guessed and this is the potential energy, what can you say about the kinetic energy in that central region? It's positive. And what is that going to mean about the wave function? If the kinetic energy is positive, it's going to curve toward the baseline. So it might, for our guess, it might look like that. It's always curving toward the baseline. Okay? Now, how about in this region out to the left or this region out to the right? How's it going to be curving? Puyi? It's going to be curving away from the baseline. And in fact, out here where the kinetic energy is very large and negative, it's going to be really curving a lot, okay, away from the baseline. Right? So there's great danger in this region and in this region that it's going to curve away from the baseline. And if it curves away from the baseline, where does it go? To infinity. So we're really going to have trouble here. There's only one way to get around that. Remember what the kinetic energy is? Is it just the curvature? It's the curvature divided by the value of psi. Now, so we want the kinetic energy out here on the right and left is going to be very high and negative. How can we do that and not have a really high curvature that's going to go to infinity? What? Who said? Somebody said? Chris? Or no, Carl? Who said? Carl, what did you say? We could have a really low value. The denominator could be very small. So the numerator can be small, not much curvature. And still the quotient can be big to give us a big kinetic energy. Does everybody see that? The only way we can survive in these red regions is to have a really small value for psi, so the curvature can be small and still have a big kinetic energy, negative, curving away from the baseline. So out on the left, it's going to have to look, and the right, it's going to have to look like that. And because it has to look like that, then we know that when we start out here on the left, it's going to have zero slope, or practically zero slope. Remember, that's what I assumed in the last one. I started with 1 as a value to start up my tracing my curve. That's fine because I can multiply by any constant. And I started with 0 slope. But I can start with 0 slope because it has to have nearly 0 slope out there. Okay, so we guess 21. Okay, so an infinitesimal denominator allows a large negative kinetic energy without much curvature, so it doesn't go to infinity. Okay, so the initial slope is 0. Okay, so here's what the computer says. It's going to go like that. Now it gets into the region which is happy town, right? Because you're always going to be curving toward the baseline. You're never going to go to infinity in there. Okay, so it goes like that. Good. When we guess 21. Great. Looks like we're home free. Okay? And of course it worked out here because we started with 0 slope. Okay? But when we go across there, boom, curve away from the baseline, it goes way down. This was a bad guess. Okay, it didn't work. Okay, it had too much energy. You see, when it was here, it was curving toward the baseline, and we wanted it to go like this, but it curved so much that it went down. So this is too hot. It's got too much kinetic energy. So what are you going to do? Antonia? Can't hear. So you're going to guess a smaller energy, so it's not curving as much toward the baseline here and doesn't go through the 0. Okay, so we'll guess 20. Okay, now that one goes across, looks just fine there, as it must, and then it looks fine here. Great, and it's not curving as much, so now it's got a chance to come down like this rather than like that. But what's wrong? What? It's too cold, right? It doesn't have enough kinetic energy. It needs to curve more in here to come down. So that one's too cold. So we guess something in between them. And then we keep guessing, right? And it's important. When you look at this program, you can press solve and it will do the guessing for you. But the first few times, you should do the guessing yourself and see how you can make it go out to the right. Okay? Okay. But but notice, for example, when you make your guess, that it's going to be closer to the red value than to the blue value. It's going to be in between them. But this one lasted longer before it got to infinity than the other one did. Okay, so it's going to be closer to red than to blue, closer to 21 than 20. And ultimately, it turns out to be 20.74, blah, 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 right? More. You'll find out when you guess, and it's good to do it the first time. It's sort of fun and mindless. You keep guessing things in between and try to make it go further and further and further and further, and it turns out you can never make it go all the way to the right. Right? And in fact, the only reason this one went all the way to the right is that I cut it off here and put a straight line in. Right? The computer doesn't have enough precision to make it stay on that baseline. You can't, but you know it's between these two numbers that are the same to 10 figures or something like that. So you know what the right energy is. And you and Ju Lee drew this 2 years ago in a class. So this is Goldilocks. She's an electron. And she throws away the ones that are too cold and the ones that are too hot and finally gets the one that's just right. Okay? Okay, so you can do it. Right? And you can do it for this, for a parabola. You can do it for any old shape you want for the potential energy. Okay? Now, so there's a solution to the Schrödinger equation for this problem, for that potential energy and that mass. Okay? Is that the only solution? Do you suppose there might be other waves that would do the trick? Can you imagine another wave that might have this property of curving toward the baseline in this central region and coming down to be asymptotic on the edge? Can you imagine another such shape? What is it? How do you know? Yeah.
So there should be solutions where it has two extremes and then one extreme.
Okay. Can you imagine what the one looks like that has one? Just looks like this, right? Okay. So we can guess a lower value. Could there be a lower energy? Yes, indeed. 4.15 works. I mean, to a lot of, you put a lot more figures on there to make it that good. In fact, you can't make it that good because I faked it out here. Okay. Now, could there be one in between those two? Yeah. How can that be? It could look like that. It could approach from the bottom on the right instead of from the top. Okay. Now, could there be any others in between those? No. Because you have these nodes, or you talked about it in terms of extrema, but you can also talk about crossing zero, right? And you can only cross an integral number of times, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on. So there'd be a lot more higher ones that cross more often, right? But as far as the low energies go, this is it. It's quantized. There are only certain values that work, right? It has to be a precise value. Okay, and a node... This isn't a node out here. It's nearly zero, but it's not truly zero. The only place it's truly zero are where the sign is changing from positive to negative. Those are what's called nodes. And we'll see why later. And notice that more energy means more curvature toward the baseline in the middle, and therefore more nodes. So the number of nodes in some way parallels the amount of energy the thing has, because it makes it curve more. Okay. Now, you can do this for one particle in one dimension, it's no problem. You just do it the way we did it, by tracing these curves out. But if you have more dimensions, it gets more troublesome. And if you have more particles, it gets really, really troublesome, especially if you have more than two particles. It turns out you can't solve it. Okay. So that's a problem. And we're going to work and make approximations to try to see about what is it. That'll be very helpful. But the question we must ask at first, is it worth all this effort? Because it gets so much harder when you get more complicated systems. What's the reward? Well, it turns out the reward for finding psi is the knowledge of everything. At least everything that's material, that's made up of particles. Right? Because this is the system that really works. So it's pretty valuable. Even if you can only get an approximate solution, it's worthwhile. Okay, now, for example, what kind of everything? The energies that the system can have. The structure, how the particles are arranged. Right? The dynamics, how they change in time. Bonding, what are bonds? Remember, that's what we're setting out to find. And finally, about reactivity, so that we can understand why certain things react with other things and how they react. So that's pretty good. Let's look at a few of these. Let's look at allowed energies and structure. Okay, so here was Hooke's law, and we had even energy spacing. If we looked here, here's the lowest one with no nodes, one node, two node, three node, four node, five node, six node, and they're evenly spaced. Except the first one is not evenly spaced from the bottom by this amount. Do you see how far it is from the bottom? How far? Yeah, it's four, but how does that relate to the gaps for the other? It's half, right? So we could even write a formula for it. The energy is some constant, which in this thing turns out to be 8.3, roughly, right? times an integer plus a half. If the integer is 0, it's a half that value, 4. If the integer is 1, it's 12.4, and so on. Neat. Yeah. Well, this is what you can find out by doing these problems, right? Try different ones and see. It's clearly true for this one. For Hooke's Law, you could try for a different mass. You could try for a different strength of the spring. Maybe there was, remember, the Hooke's Law is a spring. And the spring that you get by default when you start the program is a single bond. And the mass you use is the mass of a proton. So it's like a hydrogen held by a single bond that's vibrating. Right, and these are the energies that are allowed for it. Right, but you could try, suppose that you use the deuterium instead of a hydrogen. Would the same thing be true? Now, another way of doing this is to know differential equations and know how to solve them. And then you can show analytically that the spacing for a spring really is this way. But most of you people don't know how to do that yet. So just use the program and find out. It solves differential equations for you. Okay. Now, but so this is that game. This program is that game, right, where you can find these psis. But what do the psis mean? What are they? Is it just something mathematical? Well, Max Born in 1926, so just a few months after Schrödinger developed wave mechanics, had published a paper of which has this in it. And he said, if one wishes to translate this result into physical terms, only one interpretation is possible. Psi, this function, signifies the probability of a particular structure. Right? What's psi a function of? It's a function of position. So how likely is it to have that position? Right? He says that's psi. Now, remember what these waves looked like this, for example? So it has very low probability here. Then it would have high probability here. It would have zero probability at the node. Right? What would the probability be down here? Negative. That's weird, right? A negative probability. But notice that there's a footnote here. And he added a footnote, which is a correction in proof. So this paper was already to be published and set in type, right? And he added, more careful consideration shows that the probability is proportional to the square of the size of psi, right? So you don't have to worry about negative probabilities. But it's interesting that the first guy who proposed this interpretation that psi had to do with probability showed that it was psi squared, or made the mistake, thought it was psi, but in fact he realized it should be psi squared, not psi. So psi, in a sense, isn't anything. But psi squared is certainly something. It's a probability, according to Born. Okay, and Einstein then wrote a few months later to Born and said, an inner voice tells me this is not the real thing, the true Jacob, the real Jacob, right? The theory yields a great deal, but it brings us no nearer to the secret of the old one. Anyway, I'm convinced that he does not play dice. I bet some of you have heard that saying, right, that the old one does not play dice. Born said, how can you... I've seen so many... I wrote to a historian of science that knows a lot of this stuff to see if he knows the authentic version. On the web, you can find more than a dozen different versions of what Born said to Einstein. But the gist of it is, how can you presume to tell God what he can do, right? If he wants to play dice, that's what he'll do. Okay? Anyhow, Einstein didn't like that. Now, just a footnote here. It's actually not probability. It's probability density, the square of psi. And just an illustration of the relationship of probability to probability density. Suppose you had a flask that had mercury and then water and then oil in it. And suppose the total mass of the flask is 1 kilogram. Of the contents of the flask. Now, here's a question. How much or what fraction of that 1 kilogram is exactly 1 centimeter from the bottom? Well, of course, mercury is more dense than water and oil, so it's going to be more than you might think, right? okay? You have to be careful about smoothing your hair back. You might get called on. Okay, how much is exactly 1 centimeter from the bottom? What?
None.
Zero. Why? Why do you say none? Looks like it's mercury. That's pretty dense. How do you get mass? Mass. To get mass, you have to multiply density by volume. Right? If you have a given volume and you know the density, you multiply them together and that tells you the mass. But the density is not the mass. You have to multiply. If you have no volume, exactly 1 centimeter has no volume, then you don't have anything there. Is everybody with me on that? You have to have some volume to have a mass. You have a density, but that's what you multiply by volume in order to get mass. So the same thing is true of probability density. You have to have a certain volume over which you multiply. So if the probability, the density here is the density of mercury, over that thickness you have a certain mass and therefore a certain fraction of the total. So that's like psi squared. It has a value at a point. But how likely is the electron to be exactly at that point? Zero, because there's no volume. But in a little box around that, you multiply by that, and then you know what the probability of it to be in that box, say 1 cubic angstrom or something like that. So the square of psi is probability density. For example, electrons per cubic angstrom. Okay? We'll get back to that later. Now, then there's a thing called normalization. So remember, we could scale psi by any number we wanted to. For purposes of these graphs we were drawing, we started it to be 1. But if you want to have it such that the total probability of finding this particular electron you're interested in is 1, then integrating psi squared over all space, or taking all the little boxes in space and multiplying each one by the probability density there to get how probable is in this box, this box, this box, this box, that has to sum up to be 1. The total probability of finding it someplace. Okay? So you multiply by some constant in front such that that will be true, and that's called normalization. So the total integral of psi squared times volume is 1. Okay, now, one thing you can press on this one-dimensional Goldilocks thing is a button that allows you to plot the square of psi, where zero is down at the bottom rather than being here, of course. So this is the square of the blue one, right? This is the square of the red one. Now, these aren't normalized, right? The area, the total area of the red should be 1. The total area of the blue should be 1. They should have the same area, but we have made no attempt to normalize them. Okay? Now, it's interesting just to look at this in terms of probability. So where is the highest probability for the lowest energy, no nodes, wave function? It's here, obviously, at the bottom. Now, is that what you expect? Suppose you had a ramp like this, and you put a marble on it and let it go back and forth, right? And you took a time, suppose it had a light in it, okay? And you took a timed exposure with a camera of this. Where is the highest probability? Where is it most of the time as it goes back and forth? Why? It's moving very slowly when it's out here. Very rapidly when it's here. So it's not spending much time here. It's most likely out at the extremes. Is that what we see for the blue one? Absolutely not. It's most likely in the middle and least likely at the extremes. Now, as you go to higher and higher wave functions, then it starts to collect at the extremes. Right? So if you had a really heavy particle and had many, many, you can do this, change different masses and so on, and went to a high thing, you'd find that it would tend to be out at the extreme. So it approaches the classical limit, and ultimately looks like this, right? Mostly at the extremes. But that's not true for the low ones. Okay? But notice something else, that the probability penetrates the classically forbidden region. So here's the total energy for the red curve. It gets to here. That's when the potential energy equals the the total energy. So the kinetic energy is zero here. And out to the left of here, the kinetic energy is negative. And out to the right of there, the kinetic energy is negative. So the stuff, it has a probability of being where its kinetic energy is negative, which is said to be classically forbidden. Okay? And the same thing is true of the blue one. For the blue one, the classically forbidden region begins here, where the total equals the potential. And the blue one also has significant probability out in the forbidden region. Okay? This is the Morse potential. And notice that although the first one, the lowest wave function, this one, is pretty much in the bottom of the well, as it would be for the so-called harmonic oscillator, Hooke's law. Right? That's because the bottom of this thing looks like Hooke's law. Right? But when you get up to a much higher one, this is the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, fifth, this is the 15th wave function. Notice it spreads out to the right. And not only does it spread out to the right, but it's large on the right. Right? It's the biggest here. The biggest hump is here. Why is it so big out here? Because when it has a big kinetic energy in this region, so it's got a big kinetic energy, there's the total, here's the potential. So in this region, the kinetic energy is very big. That means whenever the wave function gets big, it has a high curvature, right? High kinetic energy, which pulls it back down. So when it raises its head up, it's like whack-a-mole, right? Whenever it raises its head up, it gets pulled down again. But out here, where there isn't much kinetic energy, it doesn't have much curvature, so it doesn't get pulled down as fast, right? So it gets really big out there. Okay, there's something else interesting here. In this region, it has something that looks like an exponential decay. It's sort of like e to the minus x. When is e to the minus x a solution? We looked at that last time. For what situation? Constant negative potential energy. Kinetic energy, pardon me. Constant negative kinetic energy. But that's what happens out here to the right. Right? Because there's the potential energy, there's the total energy, the kinetic is essentially constant and negative. Okay? Now, remember we looked at all the whole bunch of them, you know, the lowest, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth. How does this look different from a spring, from Hooke's law? Pardon me? They're not evenly spaced. They get closer and closer and closer together. Suppose you chose an energy that was higher than that gray area. Right? So it's not like Hooke's law. So energy increases along with the number of nodes, the well widens more than it did. So if you have a given number of nodes, it spreads out further to get the same number of nodes. Okay, now here, suppose we guessed 75 kilocalories, which is higher than this potential energy goes. Then what does it look like on the right here? It's a sine wave. Why is it a sine wave? Because it's constant positive kinetic energy. Right? So up here, the energy isn't quantized. You can choose, remember when you have a constant positive kinetic energy, you can have any energy you want. You just get a sine wave of a different wavelength. So it's quantized in this region for energies in this region, but then it ceases to be quantized when you're up there. Now, the most relevant thing for talking about atoms is Coulomb's potential. But of course, a real atom is three-dimensional, and we're talking one dimension. It turns out, strangely enough, that the solution is simpler in three dimensions than it is in one dimension. You might not have imagined that. I don't think I would have. So this has funny behavior in one dimension with these little forks in the middle that have to do with the unphysicality of it being a one-dimensional problem. But still, you can see interesting things about it. This is the lowest one. There's a problem in running the program here, because what's the curvature at zero? What's the problem? No, it's not that there's none. What's the kinetic energy at R equals zero? What's the potential energy? Electron nucleus at R equals zero. How high? It's 1 over R, right? It's infinite when R is 0. So then using these steps to go from one to the next is very funny if you turn out to have an infinite curvature. Right? So it's a little difficult to run the program here, but you get a pretty good idea. Okay, so there. Notice instantly that now 0 of energy is up at the top. And these are all getting close to the nucleus, stabilizes the electron. So the energies are negative, favorable, okay? So there's the lowest one, has this energy for a, okay? And it has very high curvature, so the program is approximate. And here's the next one, okay? Or the next two, actually, the blue and the red, right? Are they evenly spaced? No, obviously not. Okay, and they get closer together for the same general reason that the Morse potential does, because it broadens out very rapidly as it goes up, this potential. Okay, but there's an interesting feature if you do this, and it's fun to try to do it, see if you can do it with this program, to find a pattern in these. And you find that there is a pattern. And the pattern is that the energy is minus a constant over the square of n, where this is 1, 2, 3. So this is a quarter of the way up, 2 squared, 3 squared, a ninth of the way down from 0, and so on. So there is a pattern. Okay, so we've seen allowed energies and structures. Now let's go from structure and dynamics. So here's a single bonded hydrogen. And it's in a Morse potential, a more realistic potential, not a just Hooke's law. But it looks very similar. Okay, so there's the energy, 4.101 kilocalories per mole. Now, suppose we were to increase the mass. And for some reason, when I did this, in my head I was thinking of a carbon isotope, and I made carbon 14 instead of 12. But it can be 14, so fine. Okay, suppose we went to 14 instead of 1. Now, what influence is that going to have? Suppose we have the same energy. Guess the same energy. It worked for a proton. Maybe it'll work for carbon 14, held onto a single bond. Okay? If so, how will the curve look differently? Remember the recipe for the curvature? What's changed? The mass. So the mass is in the numerator for the curvature. It's in the denominator of Schrödinger's equation, but once you rearrange things, it's in the numerator. So if you have a higher mass, what will you have? More curvature. Okay? So here's the mass in Schrödinger's equation. If you make the mass bigger, right, you get the same energy with a bigger curvature. Okay? So if we take, you know, guess the same energy, we'll have something that's more curved, and it'll look like that and go off to infinity. It's obviously not the lowest energy. What will we do to find the lowest energy solution? How will we guess? Higher or lower energy? Lower energy. We don't want so much curvature in the middle here. We want to get something that looks like that. So we guess, we lower the energy, and we find that it's 1.15 for mass equals 14. And it has this curve, right? And notice, incidentally, that they don't have maxima at the same position. The one that's higher up is more out to the right. Does that seem weird to you? Why is it so? Because this is a Morse potential, right? It goes out wide to the right. So the higher up you get, the more you get to the right. Okay, so what if you used uranium or a marble and held it on by the same single bond? What would it look like? What would it look like? The wave function, the lowest wave function for a uranium atom held by a single bond. Patrick? Right. It would be a line right here. It would sit right down in the bottom. I mean, it would be a curve, but it would be so narrow you wouldn't see it. Certainly for a marble, I'm not positive. You could try it for uranium and see. But remember, if you're going to do uranium, you want to use very small steps because it's going to be curving so much. Okay? Okay, so there are the probability distributions for these two. And as we said, the hydrogen is a little bit further on average than the carbon held by the same bond. I mean, they're different for other reasons too, but in its vibration, that is, where the bottom of the well is going to be different if you have differently charged nuclei. So the higher energy hydrogen is shifted to the right in the unsymmetrical Morse potential. We could look, but it has probability at different values, right? Not only at the maximum, but also here. And we could talk about how far it goes in terms of the half maximum probability, right? It's half as likely to be at these positions as in the middle. Okay, so if we looked at that, we would see that the hydrogen does further excursions in its vibration than the carbon does. Okay? So the hydrogen goes plus and minus 0.1 angstrom, nearly 10% of how long its bond is. But the carbon does only plus and minus 0.05, only 3% as long as a carbon bond is. Okay? And in fact, this is what we saw last time when we looked at how the atoms vibrate. Remember, this yellow thing, when it gets small as it gets there, that's how much carbon is vibrating on the end of a single bond. Right? About plus and minus 3% of its bond distance. Okay, so that's something about dynamics. But now let's go to more about dynamics and about bonding. Okay, so now here, many of you, I think, have tried this program. So this is obviously Hooke's law, and here are two tries, right, to get out that far. Two guesses. Which one is right? What? Neither is right, right? And can you tell me in what way they're wrong? What about the red one? Right, and then it's going to go off to infinity. So that's too high an energy, too much curved. Yeah. And the blue one?
It's already curving up, as you can see, so you can already tell
it's. Yeah, it's going to go up. Okay. So for Hooke's law, the blue energy is too low, the red energy is too high. Okay. And you know what the correct one is going to look like is that. It's going to be in between these two. Okay? Now, I was not playing fair with you, because it's not Hooke's law. Actually, it's a double minimum. Okay? Each half is Hooke's law, right? But it's two Hooke's laws. Okay? And now these both are solutions. Right? They're right. They're correct. So we've learned something about when you make a double minimum out of two single minima. What about the new solutions that you get when you get a double minimum, as compared to the energy of the single minimum? How about the blue one compared to the energy of the single minimum? This is what it would be for Hooke's law for just one minimum. Right? What about the blue one? It's lower in energy. And the red one is higher in the energy. The blue one is less curved, less kinetic energy. And the red one has more kinetic energy than it would have for the lowest energy in a single minimum of that sort. So the correct single minimum energy must lie between these values. Okay, now what if the wells were further apart? Note, instead of 0.6, we're going to make them 1.3 apart, and now these are the solutions. And now notice that the solutions are almost exactly the same as the single minimum. So if they're far apart, they're acting independently, and you have the energy of a single minimum. Okay, so closer wells, as you move the minima together, you get lower minimum energy, right, than you had when they were far apart, and a higher next energy. And that's called splitting. When they're separate, you have one here and one here. When you bring them together, they interact and split their energies. One goes up and the other goes down. Now, we could visualize that here. When the wells are far apart, you have one that's something that could be in A, or it could be in B. And it would have those wave functions, those curvatures, those energies. Okay? Now, and the true wave function for something where they're far apart looks like this. It's just the sum of those two. Okay? And that it has the right curvature everywhere and so on. Fine. Okay? Now, if you bring them together, you get this, where there's not as much curvature. And therefore, what? Without so much curvature. Lower kinetic energy. Right? So this energy is lower because it's lower kinetic energy in this case. And therefore, the particle, whatever the particle is that's described by this, is lower in energy when you have the two come together than it was when they were apart. Because its kinetic energy is lower, it's not as curved. Right? That holds A and B together. The energy of that particle is lower when A and B are together. What do you call that? A situation where it's lower in energy when they're together than when they're apart.
Bonds.
And notice that in this case, this is not Coulombic. This is, remember, we're using Hooke's law because it's simpler. But the reason it's bonded is because the kinetic energy got lower. Two people voted for kinetic energy when we asked what the source of a bond was. Right? Live and learn. That is bonding. Okay? At the same time, instead of adding these two, you could have subtracted one from the other. The original one could have looked like this. So you could have that one too as a solution. But that one's higher in energy. It has increased curvature. And what are you going to call that? If you call this one bonding, that is, it helps things come together, right? What does that one do if the particle has that wave function? It's anti-bonding. It tends to force things apart if you have that wave function. Okay, so now we know, at least at this level, what bonding is and also what anti-bonding is. And I think that's all I wanted to say today, but maybe you have some questions about this. We went through it faster than I thought we were going to. Pardon me? Yeah, every particle. This is it. I mean, the one thing that's different in this from a real atom is that we're using Hooke's law instead of Coulomb. And the reason we're doing that is that the program is hard to run. First, one dimension is not such a good... There are differences in three dimensions and one dimension. So we're doing one dimension, and then things look much simpler with Hooke's law than with Coulomb's law. Right? And also the problem of having to take really, really, really tiny steps if you have this infinite curvature problem for infinite low potential energy. So I've done the illustration using Hooke's laws, but the same principle applies no matter what the wells are made of. When you have two wells come together, a particle which can be whose wave function goes over both of them. How far does a wave function go, incidentally? It's a function of position. Where does it stop? Never. But it has really, really low values far out. Right? So this wave function that has now, that if they're far apart, these two wells, right, then they behave, the energies you get are as if they were independent wells. They have exactly the same energy. Right? But when they get close together, then the particle who has this wave function and this potential energy is lower because it's less curved. Right? Now, in Coulomb's law, in atoms or molecules, there actually is a little bit of a complication because it has to do with what's called virial theorem. And although we had extra time at the end, we have only 45 seconds, which isn't enough to go over the virial theorem. But fundamentally, this is what's causing bonds. The fact that the wave functions smooth out when you bring two wells together. Yeah. Wojtek, pardon me?
Bonding is always connected to kinetic energy, right?
It's always related to it. And the fundamental reason it happens is because of this. But there's this thing called the virial theorem, which I don't want to complicate your life with before in the next 15 seconds. But I will tell you, there is a trade-off of things such that ultimately potential energy has a lot to do with it. But the only reason potential energy can do it is because the kinetic energy fell like this. Had the kinetic energy not done this, then the potential energy wouldn't have done what the potential energy did. That seems confusing to you, I'm sure. But this is the real reason that you get bonds. Okay. Any other question? Pardon me? There are going to be some other problems on Wednesday. I mean, for Wednesday. The exam, remember we decided the exam's going to be on Friday. We're going to have a review. I'm going to lead a review session on Wednesday night. I think it's best for you if you could do the quantum mechanics, the one-dimensional quantum Irvin meets Goldilocks problems for Monday, and then there'll be a few other problems for Wednesday. But, I mean, fundamentally, I don't care as long as you do them. But why don't you do it for Monday?